Welcome to Eating in Isolation, a talk show about mental health and the food industry. I'm Sue Chan.
I'm Sarah Solomon.
So today's episode with Jenny Dorsey, I found incredibly informational and educational. It was, you know, the deeper psychology behind a lot of the problems in the food industry that I certainly didn't understand. And it really feels like it gave a big picture of the broad issues and ways in which we can take small steps to create change. And I'm really excited for everyone to learn and listen.
Yeah, I think when we all think about mental health and psychology, we think about individuals and what we go through on our own. But I think it's really important for us to also take a step back and look at the macro issues that affect the industry at large, which I think does lead to a lot of the inequalities that happen in the industry, which leads to abuse and lack of infrastructure and lack of support. And I think when we take a look at those macro issues, we can really start to see where the system is at fault and how we can change the system in order to really help each and every one in the industry on a more micro level. On today's show, we've got Jenny Dorsey. Jenny is a professional chef, author, and speaker specializing in interdisciplinary storytelling, fusing food with social good. She also leads a nonprofit community think tank named Studio Atao that creates tools and resources empowering individuals, organizations, and policymakers to integrate social impact into their everyday life and work. Her personal work has been featured in outlets such as The Food Network, Oxygen TV, Eater, Food and Wine, Bon Appetit, and others. Welcome, Jenny.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit more about Studio Atao?
Yeah, for sure. So Studio Atao is a 501c3 nonprofit community think tank. We are trying to reimagine the way that think tanks are integrated into our society and how it works with different organizations and policymakers. For a long time, think tanks and I think just nonprofits, philanthropy in general, have operated from a very, very top-down model where whatever problem you're trying to solve, let's ask the people who are already in power, who are in leadership, what they think is best to solve this issue. And most of the time, they are not actually experiencing the issue. They're not affected by the issue. And they are not really the right people to be solving the issue because they don't know on the ground the nuances of the problem. You see this in like hunger, aid, basically all types of charity models. And for a long time, think tanks that make recommendations for our legislators and our policymakers kind of similarly buy into that idea of they are, you know, talking with people who are already very powerful. They do talk to experts, and that is very important. We do that as well. But too often the power and the recommendations are still concentrated from those already in power. So what we want to do is uplift and champion the recommendations of the people who are actually affected by future change. So if we are addressing inequities in food media, for example, which is something we've been working on for the last year, how do we actually talk to the people who can have comparatively less power in food media, the people who are going to be actually affected by different changes in pay, really ask the people who are experiencing the problem and use their recommendations for structural overhaul?
I want to make sure that I understand what a think tank is, because whenever that term is used, I think I kind of have a hard time grasping it. So it sounds like you guys problem solve.
Yeah, traditionally, what a think tank does is it does a lot of independent research. It's affiliated with a lot of academic institutions, and they do a lot of independent research on specific topics that are usually related to policies. And the original idea of the think tank was that it was supposed to be very neutral, and it was just giving policy recommendations and providing, you know, supplemental research. So that's why some of the bigger think tanks that still purport to be pretty neutral, both like Republicans and Democrats, will cite their work because it's not meant to sway public opinion one way or another. That has changed a lot since the mid-50s, 60s, because some think tanks do have a particular specific outlook, and they are trying to persuade public opinion through marketing, through releasing more content versus like policy-driven ideas. We are not necessarily neutral since we do have ideas on how policies should be driven. Our idea is that it should be driven by the people. So if the people have a specific recommendation, we're going to follow that. Whether how that leans, we'll see. But we don't have like a political affiliation, whereas some think tanks have a specific political affiliation.
I'm so glad I asked. I actually had no idea about any of that. That's really interesting.
Jenny, can you tell us what led you to the food industry?
Yeah. So when I first started my career, I was in management consulting within the fashion and luxury arm. So I had graduated college and always wanted to do that work because I thought it was really glamorous and cool, and very quickly realized that I just didn't enjoy it. You can only wear so many clothes, and clothes cannot fill the hole in your heart that comes from unhappiness. And I think that consumerism, capitalism has told us that if we just keep acquiring more things, eventually that will go away. And it doesn't. And I think I really realized that by looking at the partners of the firm that I was working at and realizing, if anything, I didn't envy their lifestyle. I felt kind of sorry for them. You know, I didn't want to end up like that in my 40s and my 50s. I didn't want to have that life. So I knew I needed to do something, but I just didn't know what would be the right path. I had always loved food, always loved eating, but I never thought that it would be a career for me, since my family is relatively traditional. I'm Chinese American, I'm first gen, and it was always about stability. It's always about, you know, being able to provide for yourself. And food is not a career that you just see all the time. And you know how they say, if you don't see yourself in it, you're never going to be it. Like, there was no examples for me of what do you do in the food industry? And I didn't know if I wanted to work in restaurants. But I eventually ended up taking a lot of recreational food classes. Instead of actually deciding to go into the food industry, I applied early decision to business school as kind of this like safety net. And when I got in, it felt like finally I had this, okay, I know that I can go to business school. So why don't I at least go to culinary school and see where it leads? And that very quickly became like, I need to give myself an opportunity to explore this industry. I just don't know where it's going to go. So end up leaving business school and pursuing a lot of uncertainty in food, trying out different internships, just trying to navigate what the food industry is, because it's actually quite unclear to outsiders of our industry what the potential roles you can do in the food industry beyond like cooking. You know, if you don't want to run a restaurant, there are so many other career paths for you, but that is not actually, it's not very well communicated to culinary students either. So it took some time to just find where I wanted to be.
I think in the last couple of years, we've realized how important it is to have this understanding. So curious how you landed on it, kind of seems like before everyone else landed on it.
Yeah. So when I first started, I went to restaurants just like everyone else. We are required out of culinary school to do externships. So I went and worked in restaurants, worked in fine dining. I love fine dining and I hate fine dining in many ways. I think a lot of people feel the same way. But I did learn a lot. And one of the important things I did learn is I don't want to do restaurants forever. It's not just like the lifestyle and whatnot. Those are all things we hear. But it's also the fact that I needed like more stimulation in addition to doing the cooking. Like I wanted to marry like the two sides of my brain, so to speak. And I couldn't quite find that balance. I think, you know, sometimes if you are running larger restaurant groups, you also get more like operations and that kind of thing, but that's not what I was doing. So I took a pause on restaurants and decided to try out a bunch of different internships in different parts of the industry. Was doing food PR for a little bit, did like door-to-door like sales, was a barista. I did all sorts of like just kind of random things. And by process of elimination, quickly figured out those were not well suited for me either, which I think is an important process. I think, you know, especially as children, honestly, you're a child when you go to college. And I also went to college really early. You are just not equipped to make decisions about your career. And we are not given that time to fully explore that. And then you kind of get stuck in a career or a thing that the first thing you do out of college. I mean, that I think it's really unfair to the younger generation. And I know so many of my colleagues who have worked at the same company that I started at, and they're still there, you know, 10 and 11 years. And I'm not going to posit that they're unhappy. I don't have no idea what their life is like. Maybe they're perfectly happy, but like they didn't even get a chance to explore other things. Like maybe they would have liked something else. And I think that's really, it's very unfair and it's very myopic of our society. So on a different note, after doing a lot of process elimination, I did end up in a role that I really liked. I was doing research and development and menu development at a global chain called Le Pain Quotidien. I absolutely loved the work. I thought it was super interesting. I had fun. I got to cook. I got to do menu development. I also got to do ops. I got to do some admin stuff, which was not fun. But I also got to learn about marketing. Like I got to do a lot of interesting parts of the business. Absolutely hated the company. So I felt like, okay, finally, I found a role that I like. How can I replicate this role in different ways? So I ended up doing my own culinary consulting. I still do that, just in a much more abbreviated way. And with that, also started a dinner series with my husband where I could be creative and, you know, make the food that I wanted to make, because most of the time, unless you're the executive chef at a restaurant, it's not your creative work on the table, right? It is following the orders of someone else, which is not necessarily a bad thing. I do think, you know, too many cooks in the kitchen is a real thing. If you have too many opinions on what's going out, the food doesn't really taste that great. I actually don't really like collab dinners between chefs, because often I feel like it kind of muddies one person's idea. Like, I think it's actually clear when one person is cooking. There's obviously exceptions to that, but I do think it's helpful to have clarity on one person's like point of view on food. And I felt like I wasn't able to do that at my actual job. So I wanted to be able to do so in a different creative outlet. And so for a few years, I was doing the culinary consulting thing, doing dinners and pop-ups. And that was really fruitful in many ways, but also once we were able to, you know, regularly get customers and we were selling out of tickets and all of that stuff, I realized like, wait, this is not quite right. People are just coming here for a very transactional food experience. And yes, we're here to make them feel good and all that stuff, but I wanted something deeper. I wanted to talk more about bigger issues that I was seeing in the food industry, and I think the world, but definitely the food, through the lens of food. And I felt like the outlet that I was doing so was not quite getting me there. So I slowly transitioned the dinners into much more, I think, social justice focused ideas and themes, talking about things like mental health, talking about things like, you know, failure, and think just talking about during the dinners, much more specific in terms of how I wanted people to communicate. There's this great book called The Art of Gathering by Priya Parker. And in it, she talks about how too often we have this laissez-faire. She does not use that word, but we have this laissez-faire approach to hosting. We think that once we get people in the room, we get them the food, like we as the host, we don't want to impose, right? So like you leave them to your own devices. And her argument is, if people are coming and paying for your, not necessarily paying, but they're coming to your home or restaurant or whatever, the space that you have built for them, they are implicitly entrusting you to control the narrative of their evening, of their brunch, whatever that time that they have allocated for you. So if you do not control it, you are abdicating your host responsibilities, which is the worst kind of host, because you are just giving the host responsibilities to someone else in the room. And often the person who steps up to take those host responsibilities is going to be the person with the most dominant identities in the room, which are usually like extroverts, white men. You know, I think we all know the type that tends to dominate and destroy the dinner, right? And I felt like I was also doing that because I was nervous and I was like, oh, I don't want to impose. And so I learned a lot of kind of taking a 180 from that understanding of how to direct people in a room. And it's not like, you know, you don't want to shove messages down people's throat, but at the same time, being more clear about, you are coming into the space for this specific reason. We have curated this space for you. Here's the things we want you to talk about. Here are the messages we want to get across. Just being very, very direct about that. So that's when we launched Asian in America, which is a course dinner series that talks about the Asian American identity through food, virtual reality, poetry, as well as cocktails. My husband runs our cocktail side. And through that, it was like kind of a aha moment of like, wow, food can be something more than just something that's fun or something that we break bread together. I think we're really tired of that narrative. How can food also discover depths of how we are discomforted, how we are ashamed, how we ostracize others, how we make fun and mock other people? Like, food can be a very destructive force as well. And if we can't recognize that, we can't name that, then we can't also understand it, and then we can't control it, and we can't use it for good either, right? It's kind of like you can't have one and only have the other, right? You can't have your cake and eat it too, sort of thing. So you have to acknowledge the power that food has that can be very toxic in order to, I think, wield the best parts of food.
When you say food, I just want to make sure I understand. You mean sharing food, like having the experience of sharing it, or?
I mean food in general, all aspects of food. I mean, food is something we have to eat every day. And so therefore, it's a really powerful way of controlling other people. It's how we understand each other. It's how we understand different cultures. I don't mean like, oh, look, Japanese people like kombu. Like when white settlers came and forced indigenous people off of their land, that is committing genocide, because you're erasing not only their food ways and their access to those food ways, but also all the knowledge that has been accumulated, right? Like, that is how you control people. The reasons that we even eat or drink milk is because we were living in barren, arid grasslands and humans can't process grass. So then we have cows. Cows have four stomachs. They process grass. They turn it into milk. We eat milk. But actually, 90% of the world is like lactose intolerant or something like that. It's like it used to be. I don't think that number is the same anymore. A large majority of the world is lactose intolerant. And yet the areas that have lactose tolerance, because they had the cows and milk and the butter and whatnot, happen to colonize the rest of the world. So we think it's actually very normal to be lactose tolerant and to have such a large amount of milk and dairy in our diets. And everyone who doesn't have that is seen as like weird or other or lacking something. And these are narratives that we do not discuss openly. These are narratives we absorb and are socialized and understand, and we just assume are true. And so food affects all parts of our lives and our relationships with other people, how we treat prisoners in prisons. You know, they have to eat too, and the food we feed them, quite important. So how we dole out aid, how NGOs respond to crisis. I mean, I could go on. All of those things are not ways that I think we are socialized to think about food, because otherwise then we have to deal with how ugly food can be, instead of like this just like fake idea of how we just like magically sit at the table together and break bread and all of a sudden we're best friends. Like, that is not how we solve problems. You can put all the dictators in the world in a room together with plenty of food. I'm sure they've already been in a room with plenty of food, and we still have world problems, right? So clearly it's not like a silver bullet to our issues. It goes a lot deeper than that. And I think all of that started coming up at the dinners as people were having these deeper conversations. And I recognize, like, you know, it's one thing to spread awareness, and it's one thing for people to hypothetically talk about these things in abstract. We were having good conversations about the model minority myth. We were having good conversations about the lunchbox moment that a lot of immigrant children have. But what about it? What about it? We can talk all we want about it, but if there's no action, there's no follow-up, and there's no accountability, then we've just been talking about it. And so that really spurred me to think about and start acting on, like, what can I do about this? And I don't have tons of money. I don't have tons of resources, but what can I do in my small way to act upon this? Can we choose certain issues and work on that? And that's how Studio Tao slowly became what it is today, of how do we talk to people? You know, how do we build relationships with community members that we might be in community with now, that we might not be in community with now, understand their issues, and work to solve them through their perspective. Yeah, it's been quite a journey.
You mentioned, as you were talking about the fashion industry and being there, and you mentioned the hole in your heart. And I'm just curious what that hole is like now, or what your awareness is around it now, given the journey you've been on, and how it sounds like you're doing such purposeful work. What has it been like to feel the difference?
I mean, I do think that fundamentally all humans have certain things that we want, and everyone kind of goes about it in different ways, and some healthier ways than others, I guess, depending on our past traumas and whatnot. I think everybody wants to do meaningful work or find meaning in their life, whether that's through work, or some people find it through friendships or other types of relationships, whatever that is. I think people are always trying to find meaning. And I think also people fundamentally desire to be heard, to have other people care about what they have to say, to feel important. And I don't want to make it sound like an ego thing, but like you want to feel like you matter. And so I think when I was in fashion, I had neither of those things of like, I don't understand the work I'm doing because it's totally disconnected from reality and honestly just not that important. Analysts at consulting firms are not doing very much. Sorry, analysts. I mean, like, they're just not. I would argue consultants aren't doing much either. There's a lot of like making PowerPoint slides, but how do you find a sense of purpose in that? Like, what is the good outcome or the ideal outcome that you're even driving towards? I'm not sure. So I was really struggling with that. And then I also think just like trying to be understood at the time, you can't really be understood if you're not presenting who you are to the world. People are understanding whatever you are projecting out, right? And I was not secure enough to actually be the person I really was in front of my fake friends because I didn't feel secure and I didn't think that they would like me for what I was, because all I've ever been taught and socialized is that people care about what you look like via a resume or your LinkedIn, not because of who you are and how you act. And I think an important part of culinary school was finding a group of people who really did care about me as me. And a lot of that is accepting people's fundamental flaws. If people have never seen your flaws, like, they can't really know you, right? In like romantic relationships, I'll say as an example, when you know you found that person, my husband tells me all the time, he's like, I love you no matter. I know all the things that you do that really bother me. And sometimes we argue about it, but like, even if you never change at all, I still love you very much. And I think that is so, everybody wants that. Everybody just wants to hear that or feel that, but you can't have it until you're honest with who you are. And so I think finding that step or finding the courage to be that was really hard and was definitely not where I was at the beginning of that.
Yeah. And it was in culinary school that you made that shift into feeling more secure and more confident.
Yeah, I really loved the people that I went to culinary school with. I went to a night program because I was still working. It was full of all career changers, people from so many walks of life that I just simply would never have interacted with otherwise. And I think that is really the beauty of restaurants in particular, is that you really do interact with people that otherwise you two are so different. Like, in what other setting would you meet? There were people from the military, people who are much older than me, people who had kids, you know, people who had made very different life decisions, who had very different backgrounds. I was very young when I went to culinary school. I would be like, oh, well, like, why would someone do that? Or I don't understand that. Or that seems like a bad decision, or, you know, very judgmental. And until you form that relationship with someone, until you have that amount of intimacy with someone, is when you can actually understand that, like, everybody is doing the best that they can. Everybody has a very limited amount of choices. With more privilege, you have more choices. With less privilege, the opposite. And instead of being so critical of individual choices, it's more important to think about the systems that gave them only those choices. This is like the general problem with the US and our individualistic culture, is that we're so focused on what people choose to do instead of what are the systems that gave them the choices that they had to now choose from. This goes from everywhere of like, did you eat healthy food? Well, don't eat fast food, then you won't be fat, right? To bigger issues of like, oh, well, they didn't go to a good school, or they just like compound on itself. And so anyway, I think culinary school is an important time to like realize that.
Yeah, it sounds like, it's interesting. I had a similar experience when I was doing my clinical training in South Central Los Angeles. I had the experience of seeing others who came from very, very different backgrounds than myself and relating to them on a human level. And you experience compassion in a profound way and are able to extend, you know, the kind of understanding and consideration and non-judgment that you would want someone to extend to you, to others, just by being exposed, just by hearing someone's story, just by learning a little more and not making assumptions and not making judgments. So I couldn't agree with you more. And it makes so much sense now, understanding a little bit that part of your journey was so crucial in order to want to consider the micro and the macro. You really need both.
When you start understanding people's choices and people's struggles on a more human level, you also realize that, circling back to the beginning of this conversation, is people are well equipped to make their own decisions. It is a problem when you go in to whatever, you know, it's like if you were talking to your friend, you are not equipped to make decisions on their behalf, even if they are telling you their problems. They are the best person. You can, you know, say, this is my opinion, or I see this perspective, whatever, you can help them. But like, you would never go step into your friend's life and make the decision. If they're trying to break up with their partner, whatever, you wouldn't make that decision for them. So why do we feel that it is correct for us to be doing that with more structurally vulnerable populations? Because that is what we are doing, right? We choose food pantries, we choose what goes in there, we choose who gets the food, we choose what SNAP can cover. Like, we choose all of these things, and we are effectively limiting the decisions of people because we believe that they are not equipped to make their own decisions. And that comes from a lack of intimacy with the individuals that are actually going to suffer the ramifications of the decisions that you have made.
Yeah, we're not taking the time to understand them. I mean, really what they have access to, but also psychologically, which is what's necessary. I'm curious, through Studio Atao, what has stood out to you as far as specifically mental health? Like, what are some of the things that you really feel like need to be addressed in order to help with mental wellness that your research has shown you?
Yeah. So we've been mostly working with food media for the last year, talking about like, what does equitable representation in food media look like? So at the beginning of this, early last year, we published this toolkit called Recognizing, Disrupting, and Preventing Tokenization in Food Media. After we had interviewed a bunch of different people and done, we call them experimental salons, but they're like small group discussions around representation, equity, tokenization, and food media. And now we've been interviewing, working with a large round of editors from different organizations to hear about, okay, we heard from the individuals, but what are the problems in systematically implementing changes at your organization? Because it's very difficult to, for example, one recommendation that came out is like, we need more BIPOC people in leadership roles. Okay, great. Like, that's a great recommendation. Everyone can say that until they're blue in the face. But then when you actually go into these food organizations, say like, why don't you have more BIPOC in leadership? There's a whole slew of other problems. We're trying to hire for more executive roles, and we don't have any BIPOC in the funnel. So why are there no BIPOC in the funnel? Because they usually don't get promoted and they don't get the title. So then they never get to move up. That's one issue to address. And that is like five issues under that. Of course, if you're hiring for this role and you don't have any BIPOC in the funnel, you can say, I interviewed for a few BIPOC. They were not the right fit. So I went with a white woman or a white man, which is usually what happens. And so it's like, it's not that they didn't try. They try, like, you know, it's kind of complicated. So it gets, yeah, I think the important part of all this last year of work has been, it's simple to give these big recommendations. It's much harder to be really, really specific about like, what are the process changes that needs to happen at organization level to even move in the right direction? Because you give something like hire more BIPOC in leadership roles to a big organization, who is in charge of that? Like, is the CEO going to do it? Is the DI council going to do it? Is the human resources department going to do it? Like, everyone needs to work together. And that means it needs to be a coordinated effort, which is very difficult. I mean, entire consulting firms do only change management in like one little department of a big company. I mean, I used to also work in change management. So the work that we've been trying to understand is the amount of emotional labor, not just physical and like work labor, that is required of making these big process overhauls, or at least moving towards process overhauls, is something that we consistently don't value in our society. It's not just food, but it's just across society. And where does that labor usually fall? It falls on women who are usually into caretaker roles or caring for others, or whether it's children or the elderly or whatever, or nurses, which might be a professional thing as well. And emotional labor falls on BIPOC and other marginalized folks to essentially fix problems that they did not create. When we were talking a lot about Black Lives Matter last year, Black people cannot fix racism because they did not create racism. White people need to fix racism. Too often we're like, oh, hire a token Black woman for your DEI council and she'll fix it. And that's not how things work. And so a big part of putting out recommendations now is really pointing out like, who should be in charge of doing these parts of the tactical work? And like, how do you divest away from this idea that if you just form a DEI council or task force, which I think everyone suddenly has at this point, which is good, we need that. But how do you not turn that into just another way that people who were already marginalized are get more work, not no compensation, and are trying to tackle systemic issues without the help of people who have actually created those issues, or maybe they didn't create them, but directly benefit from those issues existing. So again, whenever I talk about DEI councils, it's hard because when we ask organizations for change, they're like, oh, we'll just create a DEI council, but that's not what their people ask for. That's just what leadership thinks is the right answer. So again, we have that disconnect between recommendations from the people, demands of the people, and actual actions carried out by leadership. They don't sync because sometimes what is really needed is really radical and nobody wants to hear it. Nobody wants to hear fire your white leadership and start over. Like, I don't know if that is possible, but nobody wants to hear it. But how else are we supposed to get more BIPOC in executive roles? like somebody has to leave executive roles or else there are no executive roles to fill. So that's complicated.
My mind is going to, you know, as you're describing the emotional burden, the emotional weight on women and people of color, and the expectation that they're supposed to, that we're supposed to figure it out when the people in power are, you know, making it nearly impossible. It makes me think of the work I do in my therapy sessions with my clients when their parents have caused a lot of pain or are very limited. And there is such frustration with the children in wanting them to be different or feeling shame that they weren't enough, that they couldn't help or fix their parent or, you know, whatever the case may be. And it's a very different formula that I use because my message and my belief for us as individuals in healing is that it's not your fault. You didn't cause it. You didn't ask to be born. And you're the only one responsible for making the changes in your life personally now. Whereas that's not the case in this system that we're talking about. It's actually the opposite. We do need to hold people accountable and fight for change in a very different way. Because again, in sessions with my clients, I really push for radical acceptance of the things you cannot change. And this is much harder to navigate in figuring out, how do you keep pushing and how do you take care of yourself at the same time? And actually, I'm curious how you manage that. How do you manage coming up against these systems that are so clear to you and when to press on the gas and when to take care of yourself and step back or take care of the people that you're fighting for?
Yeah, I think it always comes down to boundaries, personal boundaries, professional boundaries, all of that, and also accepting other people's boundaries too. I think it's really important. If you look at like activists, there's been people who've been doing this work a lot longer than I have. And the only reason that they've been able to do that is because they have taken care of themselves. Nobody is helped if you burn out and then can't help anyone else. So it is important to take time to do what you need to do and de-stress in whatever way feels good to you. Everybody has their own things. And hopefully, again, some are healthier than others, but you can do both. So I think just finding that has been really helpful. I think as a small business, we're such a small team. We're only 5 people. We can't tackle every problem. We can't even tackle food media has a lot more problems than the one we're tackling. There's all sorts of other problems, you know? We can only do so much. And being not only understanding and accepting of that, but also, you know, using that as a way to be like, okay, like we're going to focus on doing the best we can here. If that's not enough, we can try again tomorrow, but we just need to stay focused. We just can't solve every problem. Even if we have great sympathy and compassion for many other problems going on, if we try to do too many problems, we run the risk of not doing a good job, not listening, you know, not being thorough. I think a lot of nonprofits, philanthropy kind of get into this, like, we need to cover the world instead of we need to really drill down. So I think, yeah, setting boundaries and like what work that we're willing to do and really hearing people when they say like, I can't take on it anymore. You know, we just had a team discussion about something we were trying to do, like some event series. Multiple people were like, okay, I'm down to the event series. Sounds interesting, but like we cannot allow it to create more outputs for us. Like we can't, you know, and so having a candid conversation about what other people's boundaries are is really important.
Sorry, I'm kind of changing the subject now because I want to get back into kitchens in the restaurant because I know you've done a lot of work in that space too. So you've said before that kitchens aren't inherently toxic or tough. And, you know, Sarah and I, in a lot of our conversations, talk about how, you know, the restaurant culture is very toxic and trying to figure out why that is. And I think you talk a lot about how ultimately it's a result of capitalism. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I mean, kitchens, like anything else, are organizations that they don't have to be one way or another. We're just used to them being a certain way. And for a long time, because of the way we treat food, the simplest way to say for under capitalism is that we treat food as like a very straightforward commodity. It's like X or Y, but X and Y are equal when that's not really the case. In addition to that, we also have a general lack of understanding of like the agricultural food supply chain. And we want everything to be made readily available to us at prices that we think are reasonable. Part of why we think certain prices for food is reasonable is because we pay a lot for housing, among other things. We pay a lot for healthcare because, you know, Americans are very, we hate socialism, even though we already have socialism, but that's a different story. So with the big squeeze that we have on like what kind of discretionary income we even have for food has to be the most we can get at the cheapest price that we can find it at. Unless you have the privilege of getting more. But that sort of like scarcity around food has been so ingrained in our systems that we kind of just see the food itself is worth to us like a very nominal price point. And then on top of that, the labor of the food is also worth to us a very, very nominal amount. So we don't really we don't understand just how much labor it requires, not only to grow and pick and distribute our food, but then for actual restaurants to, you know, prep and cook and serve our food. On top of all of these other factors, we also have this idea in our society, because of this idea of meritocracy and all of that, is that people like don't inherently deserve to make a living wage when they are working minimum wage jobs, or they're working in food service or kind of retail, like these kind of more what has been considered blue collar jobs. We don't even fundamentally think that should be true. Like right now, if you work full time at minimum wage in the US, make like $3,000 above the poverty line, like how are people supposed to survive? So of course, the same people who are working those jobs, of course, are conditioned to have the same outlook on food, right? Because they only have so much to even spend on food. It's like a very vicious cycle. And that's a bigger structural issue. But I think when it comes to restaurants, this turns into a really toxic idea of, well, we have to squeeze everything out of the people because that's the only lever that we have in terms of adjusting our profit. You can't change how much you're paying for your real estate. You can sometimes change a little bit how much you're paying for the food, the raw ingredients itself. But by far, the main expense of restaurants is labor. And so, of course, you're always trying to get labor costs down. It's always, how do we lower restaurants? The National Restaurant Association has consistently vetoed the minimum wage. I mean, who knows? We have a lot of feelings about the National Restaurant Association, but they know that that's an important way that restaurants are able to make profit right now, even though the profit comes at the expense of so many people. If your restaurant, your business in general, can only operate because the people working in it are not making a living wage, then like maybe that business just simply should not exist. And that is the problem of where unchecked capitalism runs, right? Is like capitalism is great in certain ways in terms of forcing competition so that people get better quality of products, a cheaper price, et cetera, et cetera. But at some point, like the government is supposed to provide a floor of what is not acceptable. Like if you have to exploit people for your business to operate, then like that is not a business that we should allow. But unfortunately, restaurants have all kind of like fallen into that category because of housing. And yeah, I mean, I look at places like Singapore, they have these hawker stalls, their centers. So originally there was a lot of street food carts, you know, out on the street with varying measures of sanitary, like health and all of that. And so the government moved them all into these centers, like kind of standardized sanitation, whatnot, and they do subsidize them. So when you go to these hawker centers, the food is really inexpensive. And the idea is that, you know, no matter what socioeconomic status you are in the country, which is a very expensive country to live in, you are able to at least afford food here. And so I'm not saying the government should do something quite that dramatic, but just think about like the government has intervened there and is working. So like we need more government intervention. And unfortunately, because of things like anti-intellectualism, what has been pervasive in America, not just in restaurants, but in America, is like we hate socialism. People don't even understand what socialism is, right?
Well, can you explain what anti-intellectualism is?
Yeah. So anti-intellectualism is also an interesting topic, but at its essence, kind of the disregard, the rejection, the distaste for the pursuit of theory and knowledge, the rejection of the theories and the facts of experts, of what is seen or who is seen as the academic or the institutional elite. And so this plays out in a lot of different ways, but Professor Daniel Rigney built off of the main book about Anti-Intellectualism is this book called Anti-Intellectualism in American Life. I believe that is correct. Richard Hofstadter. And Daniel Rigney built off of that and talked about three different types of anti-intellectualism. One is anti-rationalism. A lot of it is religious. So it's all about morals. It's about beliefs more so than reality. And then one is anti-elitism. So rejection of institutions, academics, experts, you know, anti-vaxxers kind of fall into that category. And then the last is unreflective instrumentalism. So unless this is helping me make money or has a specific tangible outcome, then it's not important to understand kind of like the theory behind how things work. Like, I don't want to know about how electricity works. I just want to know how to screw in the light bulb sort of idea.
Or I don't want to know about socialism.
Right. I reject socialism, but I don't actually understand it. But it doesn't matter because I don't like, you know, so this all kind of like plays into one another when I think, well, with the internet has been very complicated and confusing to acquire information just in general. We're in silos. Social media has really not helped with that. So that's a whole, you know, other can of worms. But I think with things like anti-intellectualism, we close our minds to other possibilities of how our government can be structured, of how we can legislate things like abortion or gun control. I mean, many people who are very anti-gun control is like, well, I can't imagine an America with more gun control laws because of the Second Amendment, because, you know, so we take so much to be fixed when if you really think about the world, everything is arbitrary. Some white dudes got together and wrote our Constitution. Like, that is a completely arbitrary piece of paper that we have now decided needs to rule our life. If you really think, I mean, it's absurd, isn't it?
Same goes for the Bible.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of religious texts. Yeah, I agree. It's like written in a time that is so not what we are living through now. You know, one of the faulty things with the industry is the brigade system that restaurants utilize, especially in fine dining. For the audience members who don't know what the brigade system is because they've never worked at a fine dining restaurant, if you could explain what that is and then also explain how that really affects the wellness of the employees and ultimately the culture of a restaurant.
Yeah, sure. So the French brigade system was built, created by Escoffier in the early 1900s, like 1901 or something. And the two main goals of the brigade system is efficiency and specialization of labor. So one is how do you make the most output in the minimum amount of time? And to do so, you specialize people into very, very niche sort of buckets. So one person is making the sauce, one person is cutting meat, one person is doing fish. So you have kind of like a kitchen where everyone has their own tasks, and then it gets, you know, put on the packs and everyone, like, you know, one person is putting it all together, but everyone kind of is like a little robot. So then much like the assembly line model where everyone only does like one thing, you start doing, because you only do one or two things, you do it really, really fast. However, what happens with the brigade system, which again, like, in theory is not super terrible, but the way it's kind of carried out, it's also built on a lot of this like very, very strict following of leadership or hierarchy. So if your, you know, sous chef says X, do it this way, you do not ask questions, you just do it. And so that obviously creates a lot of problems. So you have one, people who are not able to progress in their careers beyond saucier, because they literally don't have any other skills because they never been taught any skills. No one is investing in their career. No one is investing in them beyond their exact technical skill set right now. And that's like a larger industry problem of like, so who tends to end up in these very niche positions? Because you already have a lot of privileges in the world where white men tend to be the exact chefs. And BIPOC tend to be, you know, the junior staff, and then they are the junior staff forever. There was this great article about how women in the food industry tend to rise to like executive sous and never beyond that, because at an executive sous, you basically run the entire restaurant, you just don't get any of the credit. And white men are obviously incentivized to put women there because they don't have to do any of the work, but they get all the money and they get all the credit. And so it's like a similar situation. Anyway, and then with this kind of really very militaristic idea of who gets the last say, you have taken away people's agency over their, not only their work. So I want to peel carrots one way and my sous chef says no, that's minor. But when you are so, it's like Stockholm syndrome. Once you have learned that you're just not allowed to question authority, it also spills over into other things of your life. You're told to clock in at 3 hours after you've showed up. Okay, that's what my sous chef said to me. So that's what I'm going to do. You stop questioning a lot of the really toxic systems in place. And if anything, you start to perpetuate them. There's this parable, I guess I'll call it a parable, of like monkeys in a room. And so there's, I don't know if anyone's heard this, there's like 10 monkeys in a room. And then there's like a banana hanging from the ceiling. And so obviously they try to like eat the banana because they're monkeys. And every time they like grab the banana, they get like electrocuted. So all 10 of the monkeys in the room, like obviously all learn to not grab the banana, because they know that they're going to get electrocuted. And then scientists like start putting in like a new monkey. And so obviously new monkey doesn't know about the electrocution. So it also tries to grab the banana, and all the other monkeys like jump on it and is like, don't grab the banana, right? And so after a while, after they have swapped out every single original monkey that was in the room that has actually experienced electrocution. So now you have 10 new monkeys who actually never experienced electrocution. They don't actually know what the cause and effect of the banana and the electrocution are. They still won't grab the banana, right? Because they've just been socialized to never grab the banana. And I have no idea if this is true or not, or if this is an actual science experiment or just a parable, but I think that is like a very accessible way of thinking about the electrocution.
Well, in this case, normalizing deference, normalizing staying quiet, normalizing not taking action.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess that really explains why this toxic culture has been perpetuated at every restaurant and just year after year. And it's only now that we realize that change actually needs to happen. So I guess on that note, I'm curious, like, what is the future? What are changes we can make? I know we've talked a lot about a lot of macro ideas. And I think it's super important to understand like how capitalism affects the way in which the power dynamics are played out in the restaurant industry. But curious, just day to day on a more micro level, what are some changes that we can implement in order to actually make this industry different and a lot safer of a place to work and to be a part of?
I think there's a lot of things that we can do. One is for consumers to be a little bit more engaged with the places they are frequenting and asking about them and building relationships with that place. Not just, oh, I like the chef and they're nice to me and sometimes they pour me free champagne, but like, what does your ownership look like? Do your people get paid time off? You know, talking to the staff and just like getting to know how that, does this restaurant care about the community? How does it show up for the community? I think in pandemic times, especially, people were noticing that some restaurants showed up for their neighborhoods a lot more than others. So for consumers to put that pressure on restaurants is important. I think on the food media side, when we give out awards, when we are highlighting people, doing a lot more due diligence in like, it's one thing to say that this person is a genius, but it's the individual genius thing doesn't really work. I said earlier, I think it's great when you have a clarity of opinion, like one person does have to lead the menu execution. You can't have like 15 people making the menu, but one person does not execute the entire menu for 50 plus people a night. A restaurant is teamwork. And so if you are going to award or give press to a place, it needs to be for everyone. And food media has notoriously been very bad at doing that. Beverage media, I mean, all media has been generally kind of bad at doing that. Of like, how do you acknowledge the people at the bottom? And also, can a place, like there was like that big fallout with like Zaffa Wines recently, like can a place that maybe produces fantastic product, should it be spotlighted if there are toxic things happening in that place, or if it's there's toxic behaviors by one person, should that person or that business have the spotlight? I think that is a question that media in general needs to ask itself. And I think for consumers who are consuming this media to say like, don't cover this person, or I don't like this coverage, I don't want to see more of it. Like that's a feedback loop that we can all be part of. I think for those who have the privilege of being able to do so, being a lot more picky with where they are willing to work, which I do think in a time where we're all returning back to work, workers do have more power than before of being able to ask some questions of their restaurants and how to see how they're going to be taken care of. Because you don't owe anyone your labor. You are not obligated to work in one place that treats you badly. And being able to access more mental health, I think hopefully will get people to realize that, you know what, I don't deserve to be treated this way. Like, I don't deserve to be made to feel like I'm worthless or that I should get yelled at or that this is normal, and to be able to walk away. I've been very privileged in that I've worked in mostly like kitchens that treated me really well. I've had one very bad experience, but I was able to leave, you know? And so I think normalizing that as well is really important. And then finally, I think one of the problems I see with change is that we think that change like happens naturally. I think like we are lulled into this idea, I think because of where we as an Americans, generally America has been on like an upward trajectory. We'll see if we keep going on that. But generally things have gotten better for Americans over time. So we're used to seeing the future as always better. So the next generation will be better than us. Next generation will be wealthier. And we are starting to see like boomers were had it much better than we did. And we're seeing like the problem, like the fallout from that. And I think from the industry, we might recognize that in socio-political aspects, but we don't recognize that, you know, the next generation of restaurateurs, of chefs, of executive chefs are not like magically better than or more progressive or better suited to handle racism than their predecessors if they're only carrying out what they have learned from their predecessors. I mean, we all saw the stuff going down at Willow's Inn and people said, oh my God, I'm so shocked because Blaine is only 30 or 31 or however old he is. Why is that shocking? Because he's young. He's somehow just know how to treat his staff better. He's only learned in toxic environments where that's how he was treated. So how is he going to magically know how to treat his staff any different? Like, we need to break that cycle. So unless your mentors, unless the people that are currently teaching the next generation actually have a track record for creating change that you want, like they are not going to do anything except for continuing this toxic loop. I say this about mentorship programs a lot, and I think it's super toxic that we have places, I guess I won't name them, but I think we all know the main mentorship places in our industry. And when you put people like Jessica Coslow as a mentor, how is that going to help anyone? I just don't understand. Like, why do we make these choices and put them in positions of authority and power and influence to shape another more, you know, malleable up-and-coming person's perspective the wrong way? That's not going to change our industry. So how, like, yeah, who are we giving power and influence to?
I'd love for you to talk about your work on mentorship and saviorism and emotional debt. And I think that's a really good segue into that topic.
Yeah, I just recently wrote like an Instagram carousel about mentorship programs and things that I think we should be thinking about. Mentorship programs a lot of times are based on these ideas of saviorism, of paternalism. If you look at the composition of mentors versus mentees, of the board of the mentorship programs, right? Like there is clearly quite a disconnect between who has power and who is learning from those in power, and are they learning good things or not. Often also mentorship programs, especially in the food industry, are really apprenticeships. So like you're getting taught skills. You're not actually getting taught leadership development so that you can take over a restaurant. You're taught like how to butcher something. I'm not discounting the need to know how to butcher something, but a lot of times they're just like incorrectly marketed to even start with. And then you have a bunch of people who are supposed to be their mentors that might be really toxic people in the industry. So then you have this issue of like perpetuating bad examples from mentors themselves. But really, I think the main thing that ties all of the conversation we've had together today is, or mentees in mentorship programs don't have any power or say over their mentorship program, which again, who is getting the most affected in the mentorship program? The mentees. If you are not listening to the mentees, what is the point of your program? If your program is just there to make your organization look good or to make mentors look good, that's not a mentorship then program. That's a PR campaign, which is fine. Go have your PR campaign, you know? But like, don't come and cloak it in this idea and this guise of doing good. If you're not going to center your mentees and what they need, then you are just replicating the harm that's probably already done to them in the food industry. And the example that I give, because I have personally experienced it as I was in a women's mentorship program, is there were the mentorship program told us like, no child care, you know, come to work, make sure your kids are taken away by someone else. And like, what do you think is happening with working moms in restaurants all the time? They're always making sacrifices when it comes to children of care. Maybe they don't have any family to take care of their kids. If your mentorship program is literally for women advancing in the culinary industry, and you can't even solve that basic of a problem, what are you doing? Like, if you haven't considered that, I don't think you've really considered what your mentorship program is for. I mean, I think saviorism is really be grateful for what I am going to give you, because I believe me, either as an individual savior or as a savior organization, can make an outsized amount of impact in your life. You know, even though you probably are well equipped to, again, make your own decisions. And with paternalism is, I don't think that you can make your decisions for you. So let me help you make those decisions. And that is what kind of the state of mentorship programs look like, at least in food, from what I have experienced. I think almost all the time when we ask about change in the food industry, people say mentorship programs. Well, again, this is kind of like that. You can have a recommendation from people in general, but you do need more specifics around, like, well, who's running the mentorship programs? How are they executed? Or else that recommendation kind of can turn the wrong way.
So in closing, I'd love to hear if you have any thoughts on what you think is next for our industry. You know, obviously in the last couple of years, we've gone through a lot with COVID, holding people accountable in this new way. So what's next? I almost feel like we do have to kind of start from the bottom and build from there. So curious what you think is next for our industry.
What I hope we will see more of is people organizing together to, like, create models that kind of exist outside of what the traditional brick and mortar restaurants look like, and experimenting with how those work. I don't know if there's, you know, one exact solution, and there's, you know, especially for all the different problems we're facing. But for so long, we have said we can't try that because we have no, you know, we have no data on how that works, or we can't try that because the legal codes, you know, don't work that way. I've always thought, like, why don't restaurants be classified as nonprofits? Like, if you, maybe I want to run a restaurant, but I don't actually want to make a profit. Like, can you do that? You know, you can't right now because of how the legal codes work. Could we try to change that? What I hope we can collectively do is start a phase of really trying to experiment widely and probably fail a lot. But, you know, along the way, we'll find something or a few things that work better than they do now. A lot of folks have talked about, like, worker-owned co-ops as a, like, a way to work. There are definitely some issues with that as well. When things are bad for the co-op, everyone at the co-op suffers as well. So that's also kind of like, how do we mitigate against, you know, the risk of so many people and their livelihoods? But again, that's a model that we only have a few examples of right now. If we have 500 examples of it, then we can probably pick out, you know, the top five examples that we can continue to reform with. We just need a lot more, like, iterative testing. And for a long time, the food industry and the restaurant industry has kind of discouraged that because of, like, anti-intellectualism of, like, you need to just do it the way it is. And I think, if anything, the pandemic has taught us we can try different things. And also, like, legal codes, like, you're not allowed to sell on the street. You're not allowed to, like, legal codes can change. Like, law is very flexible because, again, it's very arbitrary.
I feel like that sounds like a hopeful yeah. way to end this, an optimistic way. Jenny, thank you so much. Really appreciate your time. You're obviously extremely intelligent and have lots of really amazing ideas.
I learned a lot.
Yeah. So thank Wonderful. You very much.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for today's episode of Eating in Isolation. Thanks for tuning in. Episodes out every Tuesday. Follow us on Instagram at @CareofChan. Email us questions and ideas at eatinginisolation@careofchan.com. To find Sarah, visit SolomonTherapy.com. And remember, you are not alone.